Library branch at the Multnomah County Library in Portland. Classical Music Confidential will be hosted by Bruce Charles, and we'll take a look at Portland's secret classical music past of the 1940s. Again, that's Classical Music Confidential on Monday, February 10th from 11 a.m. to noon at the Central Library branch of the Multnomah County Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least six nations. For 6 years, Ryder has been band leader for Jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, today, I am going to be joined in just a moment by Dr. Henry Nyman, Ph.D., he of Recombinomics, and if you're a longtime listener to this program, then you know that he has been on in previous years. He was on back in 09 and 14 when we had some virus talk to do. And Dr. Nyman he got his PhD in Southern Cal in 78. He's been a founding researcher in monoclonal antibodies, I hope I said that right, and an international recognized top researcher in the evolution of viruses through recombination. So he'll be here, and but before we start, I just want to say that the latest news on impeachment is that the New York Times says that they think the Democrats think that maybe they don't have enough Republican senators to get witnesses, which would mean that the whole thing will be wrapped up pretty quickly, and Mitch McConnell will bring the trial to an acquittal verdict. And so that'll be interesting to see how that all comes out. It's been interesting to me. I wonder if it galls you the way it galls me when the Republicans talk about how the election has to be respected. Elections have consequences, and I always want to say, yeah, 66 million people, the majority, voted for the other candidate. Let's respect that, shall we? But of course, we're not respecting that. You'd think that would be a sore point with them and they would not bring it up. But I think it's also a sign of the times that the big lie works so well. And whatever topic Trump or the Republicans bring up can be promoted so fiercely and so long that it simply becomes reality in the minds of the majority of the American public. And they kind of forget what happened just a few years ago when that, like George Bush's, George Bush the Lesser also won with an asterisk, with quotation marks around it, and it was the Supreme Court that put him through, not a majority. So that's the peculiar times that we live in. And also, to set the stage here to talk with Dr. Nyman, you may have noticed today that the numbers are really increasing with the novel coronavirus. The World Health Organization is reconvening today. Let me pass on a little bit of that. I'm going to select Radio Havana, Cuba for that, in line with my conceit that this is the news you're not supposed to know. And so quoting them, they say, the World Health Organization says its emergency committee would reconvene behind closed doors today to decide whether the rapid spread of the new virus from China now constitutes a global emergency. They quote the World Health Organization chief, Ghebreyesus, saying, quote, I have decided to reconvene the International Health Regulations Emergency Committee on the new coronavirus to advise me on whether the current outbreak consists of public health emergency of international concern. And this comes as the that was the end of the quote. And this comes as the health body confirmed there are 6,065 confirmed cases globally, 9,239 suspected cases, which has resulted in 133 deaths that they know about so far. The virus has also spread to 16 countries, the latest being the UAE, in which 4 cases were reported from individuals traveling from Wuhan City. And Wuhan City is something we'll be very much talking about in the coming half hour. And now you may have been expecting, if you keep track of this, I alternate first and third. I do a half hour show, and normally on the fifth I do a full hour show, but I'm not today because I've got a minor health problem, but it's a tricky darn minor health problem. And I'll be over it before too long, but right now I'm kind of a mess, and so half hour is what we're going to do. Let's see, that covers the news brief, so hopefully Dr. Nyman is on the line. Dr. Nyman, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Teresa, good talking to you again.
It's good talking to you. I'm so glad that you could come back and talk to our People's Community Radio station. You've been on national radio and all kinds of media, and so I really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. You were here during the 09 swine flu pandemic and the 2015 Ebola outbreak, or 2014 maybe it was, and I want to quote Wikipedia's entry on that flu back in 09, just in case people are forgetting. The virus appeared to be a new strain of H1N1, they said, which resulted when a previous triple reassortment of bird, swine, and human flu viruses further combined with a European pig flu virus, leading to the term swine flu. And it's estimated that 11 to 21% of the global population contracted the illness, and somewhere between 151,000 and 579,000 died. So it was serious business. And you specialize in recombinant viruses. So those were very interesting conversations. And now we're looking at a new infectious disease out of China, the so-called Wuhan novel coronavirus. Seems to be a cruel disease, hundreds of dead at least so far. So I want to ask you to describe it. What's going on with this?
Well, it's a coronavirus that's related to the SARS coronavirus that caused the outbreak back in 2002-2003. And then there were about almost 800 died, and about 8,000 were infected. And it did migrate out of China again. It started in Guangdong province, and then there was the virus evolved and ended up was a physician who had been treating patients in Guangdong province. He went to Hong Kong for a wedding. He had been infected. He went to the Metropole Hotel, and he infected good percentage of the people that were on the floor he was on, up on the ninth floor. And then they flew out to Toronto and Hanoi and Singapore. And,
so you can even say the hotel that he stayed at. We can dial it down to that one person.
Yeah, it was one person and one mutation, actually. It was in the ORF8 gene. It was a 29 nucleotide deletion. And essentially, all of the sequences that came out of people infected outside of mainland China ended up having that same deletion. So it was pretty clear that it did start with just one person, and everybody kind of wondered what would happen if there were 10 people that were kind of super spreaders like that. And we may find out with the current outbreak. The current outbreak is actually past SARS, and the numbers you gave actually were a day old. So okay. As of last night, there were 7,711 confirmed, 12,167 suspect, for a total of 19,878, and there were 178 who had died and 124 who had been discharged. So the vast majority of the people are still in the hospital. And the number is a little bit misleading on what's been stated in the media, because they've just been counting the confirmed. But the suspect are actually PCR confirmed. They kind of, to be an official confirmed case, they have to test positive twice. And so what's typically done is they are PCR tested at the local lab, at the provincial level. And then they send the samples on to the national lab, which happens to be in Wuhan. And then they have to run a second test to confirm it, and they're backed up. So that
okay.
This 12,167 have been PCR confirmed locally. They haven't been double-checked yet by the national lab.
Okay, so just by logistics, it's kind of...
They almost all get confirmed because the PCR test is pretty accurate and pretty sensitive.
What's that stand for, PCR?
Polymerase chain reaction. It's the way the genetic information is amplified so that they can get a signal, so they can take a small amount of virus or RNA and amplify it. It was discovered back in 1980, and it's pretty much the standard for doing diagnostic tests, especially on things like viruses where you have the probes. But you have to have the specific probes, and that can lead to delays. This is a new virus. It was sequenced very quickly, and the sequences were published. And then with those sequences, you can design a PCR test, which is specific for this particular virus. You basically use the sequence to make little primers on different places in the virus sequence, and then the polymerase chain reaction kind of fills in the gap between those primers, and you can make it very specific. And
so this makes a pretty quick test.
It is a quick test, but it's getting it distributed in the United States. The CDC hasn't distributed it yet. So right now, the tests are still, the samples are still sent to the CDC to get confirmation. In China, they have it pretty well distributed. They also have it in Canada distributed. And your listeners might have heard about the, they've got a cluster there in Toronto. And the first case was identified in Toronto, and they called a press conference, and they didn't call it a suspect, they called it a presumptive positive. And then they sent the sample on to the national labs in Winnipeg, which confirmed that case. And in the meantime, the index case's wife developed symptoms, and then she was positive. So they've got two positives in Toronto, and they've subsequently got a positive in British Columbia. In the U.S., we have five positives.
Okay.
The first case was identified in SeaTac in Seattle Airport in Washington State. That was followed by a case in Chicago, an Illinois case. Then it was followed by two cases in Southern California. One was in Orange County, the other was in L.A. County, and then there was a case in Maricopa County, Arizona, which is Phoenix. And so there's been five cases. The CDC is holding a teleconference in 15 minutes, and that's when they announced the other ones. But they are going to do periodic press releases almost daily, and today's actually starts it in like 15 minutes or so.
That's the Centers for Disease Control out of Atlanta.
Correct. And they do teleconferences that reporters can call in on, the public can call in on a separate line. And then usually audio tapes of the teleconference comes out within an hour or two, and then it transcripts usually within a day or so.
Well, Dr. Nyman, I'm really glad to get you on, because it's these sort of details that I really want to dial down on. I mentioned the 2009 flu. There was some talk in the media that the whole thing was a fraud and a hoax, and I think that would be difficult. It would be hard to make that case to the, maybe 500,000 people who died of it and all the people who got complications from it. It's like, this is I'm looking at this and I'm thinking there's some possibility this could be a serious thing. And it's these details that make the difference. So I'm really glad to have you in. Yeah. It seems to be a cruel disease. It seems that it attacks elderly people, and it is it a pneumonia sort of thing, a viral pneumonia?
Yeah, it's really the same type of disease as SARS, which was severe acute respiratory disease, and MERS, which is in the Middle East respiratory disease. And now this one doesn't have much of a name other than novel coronavirus 2019, and haven't really given it a more descriptive name than that. But it is closely related to the SARS coronavirus. A natural reservoir is actually in bats. It's also the same for SARS. There was an intermediate host like civet cats. Some of your listeners might remember. It was like 17 years ago, but they had wet markets there that basically people can buy exotic animals to eat, and they basically slaughtered them on the premises there.
So that brings up that term zoonotic. Is that how you say it? Zoonotic or zoonotic? It came through animals.
Right. It jumps from it goes from the animals to humans when they come in contact, and so there's usually an animal host where the virus is able to thrive, and usually the host doesn't get sick. They basically have a symbiotic kind of relationship, and bats are well known for having many different coronaviruses. After SARS, two new coronaviruses were identified that caused respiratory disease in humans, but they're mostly in children, and they're milder. And prior to SARS, there were two other ones that were caused mild cold-like symptoms in humans. So there's four mild ones, and there's three severe ones. There's SARS, which really hasn't been seen. Actually, there were two outbreaks. One was another one happened right after the first, and so SARS hasn't been seen since the beginning of 2004. MERS showed up, I think, in 2012 in the Middle East, and it still comes out there periodically. It's kind of taken up residence in camels, so that's why it's pretty much limited to the Middle East, although there are occasional exports, but nothing like is happening with the novel coronavirus right now. This particular outbreak is by far worse than either SARS or MERS. The number of cases, I mean, you can just do the math, and the numbers you gave were compiled 24 hours before the numbers I gave.
So let me ask you about that. It seems to be spreading. Is this an exponential spread at this point?
Yeah, it's pretty much gotten into, when you put the two numbers together, it is exponential. There were, it started in mid-December, and really started to take off probably within the last couple of weeks or so. And like I say, there's more at this stage in the at this date from the SARS outbreak. There were only 300 cases and 5 deaths. So the big difference between 300 and 20,000.
Okay, now I want to ask you about that in just a second. Let me give the ID here. So you're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'm on the line with internationally consulted Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD. Experienced and one of the groundbreaking researchers in recombination of viruses. And I want to also point out that you can get this on podcast. You can get this on Apple, Stitcher, other podcast distributors, and also you'll be able to get it on KBOO.fm, where you can find this and many other shows. Just use the search bar there, and don't forget to donate to us, because this is your people's community radio station. And our agenda is your agenda because of that way, because that we are funded by you. And please take that seriously. But whether you're funding us today or not, pull up kboo.fm and get information for and by the people. Now, Dr. Nyman, you've mentioned a few times, you mentioned peptides, talking about the genome, I assume. This thing that's coming out, I have so many questions about it. This coronavirus, you say that it has these 29 differences, and is that how you can tell that it came from the bats, or is this something that was observed?
No. Just to clarify, the bats, you know, because you compared the sequences. It's almost like doing a Google search. Uh-huh. So if you have the sequence of the virus, and you there's a public database called GeneBank, and one that you have to register for, which is called GSAT. And if you take the the GeneBank is going to be more diverse. GSAT was actually set up for influenza, and they just started taking coronaviruses based on this outbreak. And,
okay.
And so the database is fuller at GeneBank. There's I think 41,000 coronavirus sequences at GeneBank. And so if you take the sequence that it was published several weeks ago, there's now 50 different sequences from this outbreak. Three were just added a couple minutes before this show went on the air.
Oh, and, wow.
And they're very fast. There's a cluster in France that was just announced 3 days ago, and the first two cases in Paris came out yesterday already. And so they're coming out within a few days of actually being identified. There's many different labs around the world that are involved with these sequences. There's quite a few in China alone. I want to talk about some that are related to the ones in the U.S. They are actually related to a cluster that was in Shenzhen, which is right next to Hong Kong and Guangdong province. Guangdong province is where the SARS outbreak began.
Right.
And got a few changes in this, and one of them is in the same gene that had that 29 nucleotide deletion. Now the 29 nucleotide deletion came up later in the outbreak. The outbreak started for SARS. It started in November, and this deletion was not identified until that outbreak in the Metropole Hotel, which was at the end of February.
Okay, now how stable is this thing then? Is it likely to change?
No, it's changing. I'll give you, it's changing as we speak, and it does change by recombination.
Okay,
the SARS coronavirus is well known for recombination. Somebody I actually was at University of Southern California with, I was a graduate student, and he was a professor in the microbiology department. His name is Mike Fly, and he actually showed that coronaviruses did recombine. He published a paper back in 1992, and he's kind of known as the godfather of coronaviruses now. He's actually in Taiwan now, but in any event, the virus does evolve by recombining, and to recombine, you really have to have two different versions of the virus in the same host. And because of the concentration, that there is evidence for recombination. Actually, there was evidence of recombination in SARS also, even though all the international cases really came from that one incident at the Metropole Hotel and one person, you could see individual changes. The genomes got like 30,000 letters, and each mutation involves one of those 30,000. And initially, they all look the same, like the consensus sequence, but then they start picking up these individual point mutations, and then you can compare the sequences, and you see the same mutation is in more than one isolate, and they're shared. You can kind of see how they're evolving. And then when they recombine, you can see who the parental sequences are. So one mutation was in one version of the virus, and another one's in another version of the virus, and then all of a sudden both of them are in a new virus.
And you have no shortage of samples now. I'm getting a note here that Russia has closed the China border. We know Correct. That Wuhan is locked down, and it says 7,000 people are being held on a cruise ship in Italy because of the coronavirus. And, so the quarantines are starting to happen.
And Hong Kong has closed their border. The U.S. pulled its personnel out of Wuhan. Japan did the same thing. Japan pulled 200 of its personnel out, and when they got back to Japan, three were infected. And so there's three positives out of those 200, and they're basically, you know, looking at the other 197 to see if any of them are developing symptoms. But that just came up. The one of the clusters that I was most interested in actually is in Shenzhen, and the Guangdong CDC deposited sequences about a week ago, and three of them were marked as a Shenzhen cluster, and the sequences, all three were the same. And then that cluster was actually written up in the Lancet a week ago, and they gave more details. And it was a family of, I think, five went from Shenzhen to Wuhan to visit relatives who were had pneumonia. The relatives infected them. They came back to Shenzhen. One of their family members that didn't go to Wuhan was infected. And so it was written up as an example of human-to-human transmission. And then one of the more alarming things that came out in that Lancet article was they had brought an eight-year-old, either son or grandson, depending upon who you're talking about. But he was 10 years old, and he did not have any symptoms, but he was tested, and he tested negative. And his parents insisted that they do a CAT scan on him. And, you know, initially they said, yeah, he doesn't have any symptoms, and he tested negative. He was with you, but he didn't get infected. You don't really have to do a CT scan. They insisted. They did a CT scan, and he had damaged lungs, indicated that he either was or was currently infected.
How confusing. How confusing.
Yeah, well, it's just even more confusing because there's a cluster in Germany, and that cluster is with an auto parts store that is a, you know, an international company, and they have offices. I think they have 11 cities in China. One of their employees from Shanghai came to Germany for a meeting. She did not have any symptoms. He did develop symptoms on the plane returning to Shanghai.
Okay.
And then one of the people in Germany developed symptoms, and then three of his coworkers developed symptoms. So there's four confirmed cases in Germany, and there's about 30 other employees that were tested yesterday, and there aren't any results back on them.
Well, Dr. Nyman, we are already running out of time, so I need to hit you with the big questions. Do we have any estimate with the percentage of mortality of infected persons with this?
Yeah, it's pretty alarming that right now there are more fatalities than there are discharges. There's 170 fatalities.
Oh, so is it like more than 2% mortality then?
No, that's over 50%. I mean, there's literally the case fatality rate is the number dead over the total number. And
well, it's way different from what I thought.
So those are the ones with outcomes. Now, there will probably be more discharges, and that number will come down. Right now, it's at the 60% case mortality rate. It'll come down as more are discharged, but there will be more deaths. There's
All right, and we have pretty much
hundreds in critical and you know, like a thousand, almost 1,000 that are severe.
So this this answers my big question, which is apparently this is a very serious outbreak. Well, Dr. Nyman, thank you so much for joining us and for taking time with our community radio station. I want to say, if you're pulling up the podcast, please rate and review so other people can find this information. And I think the information that we just heard is very significant for what we've got to look forward to. Obviously, we're going to be looking at quarantines in the United States. I'll just hop out there and say that. So we're going to need to prepare. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Stay tuned on KBOO.FM, where we go out to you and all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Next, on a special edition of Sprouts, we take a look at how the Internet has attracted millions of believers to the Flat Earth Society.
And welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Hey, I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM. Today on Sprouts, you guys are in for a treat. I'll be interviewing Mark Sargent, the leader of the Flat Earth Movement, where we discuss how the internet as a free platform has enabled him to grow his numbers of followers way more than previous Flat Earth movements could. So stick around, it'll be a great half hour, and let's get to it. Today, I've actually got a very special guest with me. His name is Mark Sargent, and I'm going to let him explain what he's all about. But I think this is going to be a very fascinating conversation, and it may not be something that you necessarily expect. And if you have any idea of what he does, you can look at his background from behind him right here. But I just saw him on a documentary called Behind the Curve, and I had to reach out because I wanted to talk about the internet and proliferation of groups like what Mark is leading. And so with that, Mark, thank you for joining me. And can you tell the audience just a little bit about what you're about and what's going on?
Yeah, thank you for having me, first of all.
My pleasure.
Thank you for reaching out. And before we even get into it, yeah, your listeners, viewers/readers are going to come back at you for this. Because you're obviously giving a crazy person a platform. Ooh, I should say flatform.
There you go.
Because I just thought of that. Because yes, I am a Flat Earth advocate. One of the people, if Flat Earth was software, we are now Flat Earth 2.0. Flat Earth has been around for a really, really long time, but only in the last 5 years ago, or the last 5 years or so, have we turned it into something really, really big on the internet. And we'll get into the why here in a second, but the short version of what I believe is that we're not living on a silly little rock that's flying through space in multiple directions in a possible universe. We are in a building with walls and a floor and ceiling, and like a snow globe, a planetarium, a terrarium, whatever you want to call it, and that it was built for a reason, and that you're not an accident, and you're part of something much more intimate and much cooler. And for whatever reason, it's been gaining an amazing amount of traction. And so, yeah. That's what I believe in.
Oh, and thank you for that. I mean, obviously, I think most of the world is contrarian to your beliefs in that sense, but I find this interesting. And the focus of my conversation as I was, you know, talking to you before we started recording here is not actually on like the Flat Earth belief system, you know, itself. And obviously, I will
as I mentioned, give you a chance to plug it if people want to learn more about you. But because my show is basically on technology, cybersecurity, and all of that, one of the things that I find absolutely interesting, and I did a little bit of homework on Flat Earth, is basically how you recruit and how you grow your numbers. Because what is unprecedented in humanity, for basically the history of it, is this massive communication platform that is the internet. And so when I was looking this up, from about 1970 or so to 1990, which was kind of what I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, was a revival of the Flat Earth movement. They grew to about 3,500 or so, and then in the late 90s started declining until it was rebooted in 2004 when it turned into a discussion forum online and then started attracting members. I'm very curious to understand, because we've got a lot of different groups out there, you know, that most of the time their members wouldn't be able to find each other if it wasn't for the internet.
Right.
And so I'm curious to know how the Flat Earth has grown since 2004. It was a discussion forum, you know, what your marketing strategy looks like, you know, in terms of that, because obviously you're trying to attract new members to your movement, to your cause, to your belief, whatever you want to call it. Right. And I think it's absolutely fascinating to me, and, you know, and just not just Flat Earth, but other groups that basically find themselves. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Not much. As a matter of fact, you know, Congress got involved beginning of last year, where, I mean, I was stunned. I was watching on television where they had the head of Google and the head of YouTube up there, and they were asking them, you know, it was the big fake news discussion, which was, you know, and I understood why. So real quick, between 2004 and 2014 or so, not really much happened. I mean, Flat Earth was out there, of course, but it was really ethereal in nature. And I'm going to take, you know, as much credit as I can, which was, I looked at it in the summer of 2014, and there really wasn't that much out there, and I hated it like everybody else. I thought it was terrible. It's like, oh, this thing. And I was a conspiracy guy. And
so you didn't believe Flat Earth until about 2014. I just want to make sure I understand.
Oh yeah. I didn't even give it the time of day. And I was a conspiracy guy. I have an opinion on just about every conspiracy you could think of.
Like what? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, take your pick. I mean, I don't want to turn this into a conspiracy show, but if you can think of it, I've looked at it. So everything from, you know, do I think that 9/11 was an inside job? I've got some.
Gotcha.
I do. Gotcha. But do I think that Bigfoot had Elvis's baby? Probably not.
Gotcha.
So, you know, there's this huge spectrum. And again, I had my opinion. Everybody knows about Flat Earth. Everybody's heard it. I've yet to run into a single person. It's like, Flat Earth, never, you know, no idea what you're talking about. Everybody knows about it and everybody hated it. And it was really just on my bucket list. It was like, all right, fine. You know, I saw a couple of videos on YouTube and I thought, okay, I'll look at it. I'll crush this thing. Everybody hates it. And everyone does the same thing. They try to destroy it. And in fact, it's one of my t-shirts, which is, you know, I every day I wake up and I try to destroy Flat Earth, and every day I fail, and it's so frustrating.
Meaning you try to disprove the theory?
Oh yeah. Everyone wants to go back to their normal life, because once you go down this rabbit hole, you're stuck. That's it. I mean, we have a 99% retention rate, and it's ridiculous. It shouldn't be that way. But let's get back to the technology side of it. So I went out and I worked for about 9 months on this thing off and on, trying to disprove Flat Earth. And then I said, you know what? I'm gonna go the other way. I can't prove the globe in a court of law anymore. And that's really the big premise here, is like, can I prove Flat Earth to you right now? No, I can't.
Okay.
Can I create so much reasonable doubt in the globe that the only thing you have to go to is some sort of Flat Earth model? Yeah, I probably can. And you say, well, reasonable doubt isn't enough. And it's like, well, it is in court all day long. I mean, reasonable doubt is one of those things. So I made a series of videos, real short. You know, when you start out on YouTube, you don't even get to make long videos. You have to make short videos, like less than 15 minutes. And I called them the Flat Earth Clues. And I said, okay, here's why I can't prove the globe anymore. Threw them out on YouTube and said, you know, let them come at me. And I really thought some academic, somebody with a PhD was going to come call me. And I put my phone number out there, my real address, my real name. I said, shoot me down, please. Okay. And they didn't. So it just started getting, and what I had done was I inadvertently created the dummies guide for Flat Earth. And I know that sounds kind of redundant, but that's really what I had done. And people just started getting a hold of me. It's like the masses, you know, started, it's like, oh, this is really, really interesting. And then the media, it's like, oh, tell me more about it. And then subject matter experts, you know, people I would have never thought of, you know, pilots and all branches of the armed forces and engineers and air traffic controllers and all these guys saying, you know what, not that nuts. Here's why. And through YouTube, YouTube. I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. Without YouTube, we wouldn't even be talking. It just started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there was this weird combination of organic growth, because people thought, again, it's an interesting topic. Whether you love it or hate it, it's really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And then we had these media spikes every once in a while, or some high profile person would make some statement about it. And then it would get this big boost, and it would just start ratcheting up. So in 2016, we had rapper B.O.B. go against Neil deGrasse Tyson. Brilliant. The guy, you know, B.O.B. nominated for a Grammy, Neil Tyson, the most popular scientist in the world. You know, that took us through 2016. And then 2017, we had athletes like Kyrie Irving and other basketball players get into it. Mm-hmm. 2018, we had the documentary, was shot in 2017, but really wasn't.
The behind the curve, the one I saw on Netflix.
Yeah, that really set things off. And I had nothing to do with the production of it. That was just a like anything. Some film group out of Los Angeles followed us around for 9 months in 2017. And they, honestly, they had no confidence in it whatsoever. In fact, I didn't either. And it's like, you know, producers come, producers go, and you see projects fizzle out. And this thing was really interesting. They said, okay, we'll send it to some film festivals, right? And it's like, well, it probably won't get accepted. And it did every time. And it's like, well, okay, it's in some film festival. It's not going to get bought. And it did. And so that's kind of where, between that and the you know, all the other little things in social media that were connected to it, it just kept growing and growing to where, and to your comment in the beginning, you know, we're not actively recruiting members. There's no council. There's no, you know, we don't have any form. There's, you know, no address for the Flat Earth Society. We're not tied to the Flat Earth Society in any way. We're just the social media version of Flat Earth.
Well, then I think that actually strikes at what I really want to talk about in this conversation, because, you know, I wrote an article for Michael Smirkanish of CNN called Crowdsourcing Our Outrage. And it wasn't on Flat Earth, but I actually mentioned Flat Earth in it, where you've got a lot of people that normally wouldn't find each other. So I would have to imagine that most, for example, Flat Earth members, when they are, let's say, offline out of the internet, they're surrounded by their family members, and their family members are like, are you high? You know, like
oh yeah,
why do you believe this? And so they find camaraderie, they find a common ground with other Flat Earth members that they wouldn't normally find if it wasn't for the internet. Like, I have to imagine, to grow 3,500 users, you know, 3,500 members of Flat Earth between 1970 and roughly 1990, that would have to take a lot of, you know, you'd have to have a newsletter, you'd have to have some kind of platform prior to the internet. And I have to imagine that even if you're not actively recruiting, you're putting out this information, and then the media picks up some of it. You know, like, I'm surprised to hear Neil deGrasse Tyson even debate this issue. I would imagine that that's not something that he would want to do, you know, unless he's really just thinking, okay, this is growing to a point where I think I need to, as a noted scientist, address this. And so in that sense, you know, you're using YouTube as a platform for de facto recruitment. And so I'm curious to know, then, you know, here in the beginning of 2020, what are the numbers right now? Do you have an estimate? In the documentary, I saw that you guys had your first annual convention. I believe it was in North Carolina. You know, so you obviously have enough momentum, and you are collecting, let's say, enough money from people that are signing up to this to be able to put on a conference. And so by virtue of that, if I'm looking at the internet as a whole as a platform for people to find each other, you know, I have to imagine from YouTube, you've sprung up a lot of things like message forums or however that works for you guys that is allowing you to perpetuate and kind of recruit, even if you're not, you know, sending somebody a mailer or whatever that is, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Neil Tyson was kind of ahead of the game in that he was worried, and there were other groups that were worried. National Geographic got a hold of us, and they ran a story and took me down to Los Angeles, and the reason why they were concerned was there was a survey, and I don't know if you know any of the big survey groups, one out of London called U.gov. And
not off the top of my head.
That's right. Well, U.gov, European group, they said, oh, we're going to poll 10,000 Americans, just random Americans, and see what they think about Flat Earth. And the general numbers were skewing 3-5% until they got to, you know, overall, but the number that really spooked people was the 18-24-year-olds. The 18-24-year-olds, it was over a third, like 34% were doubtful of the globe. And they thought it was an anomaly. In fact, other scientific groups were going after U.gov. So, well, you're obviously doing the survey wrong. It's like, what are you talking about? This is what we do. It's like, we're not screwed up. And we were finding that more and more and more, to where, in fact, legally, you're not even supposed to talk to anybody under the age of 18, you know, because of child laws.
Right.
But I can tell you, after the documentary, one of the big reasons why the documentary skewed the way it was, the director hated Flat Earth by the time he was done. Oh my God. The big reason was, though, at the end, if you remember the documentary where that 12-year-old kid walked up to the microphone and was asking me questions, that really freaked out some people, because they're like, wait a minute, what's happening? You know, if the kids, you know, because as you know, the kids are more pliable. And so under 18, we're over 50% right now. And
so are you saying 50% of your membership is under 18 years of age?
No, not at all. I'm just saying that if you're under 18, you are, not only do you know about it, you're way more accepting of it. Like a lot of things, you know, which is why I use the Truman Show reference. You know, we believe the world that is presented to us, and children are, or people under a certain age. Basically, the short version is, as you get younger in the demographics, you skew more, you know, more credibility is given to social media. And that's probably one of your follow-up questions, which is, I run into younger people that basically, if you have, which is just mind-boggling to me.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM. And with that, let's get back to our interview with Mark Sargent, leader of the Flat Earth Movement.
If you have millions of followers, doesn't matter if you purchase them or not, or if they're absolutely real, if you have millions of followers listed in any form of social media, you are instantly credible. Mm-hmm. Absolutely instantly credible. I mean, to the point where you're as credible as CNN or Fox or ABC or NBC.
Right.
And it's all coming through the same device.
Yeah, but I think that is actually part of a follow-up question, if you will, in the sense that one of the things that I write about and I talk about is misinformation and disinformation campaign. You know, like, let's say a foreign government, for example, could go ahead and run a disinformation campaign in, let's say, an election or something else to sway the electorate. We have seen, and studies have borne out, that a lot of social media platforms, or people rather that use, like, let's say, the Facebooks of the world, tend to get the information from their friends posting on this. And it's not necessarily that their friends are journalists or vetting this information. They read the headline, they find it interesting, they put it out there. And now suddenly we've got people, you know, that are believing things that they shouldn't necessarily believe in that sense. And you know, because it's not been vetted and all of that. You know, I think there would be an argument, let's say, for Flat Earth, or, you know, you can take another topic that I think has really sprung up and found a lot of camaraderie online, like the anti-vaccination movement and, you know, some other stuff. So in that sense, you know, how do you present yourself as not fake news when 99.999% of us right now on the planet, myself included, I mean, I'm the first to admit, I don't believe what you believe, you know, and so I'm curious to know, like, how you guys say, well, this isn't fake news. You know, and hang on one second. Because one of the things I saw in Behind the Curve was that, you know, your people tried to make some attempts, you know, with the laser and the light, trying to, you know, prove that the earth is flat as opposed to curved. And, you know, those experiments failed, or they were not being executed properly or in some way, shape, or form. The result did not definitively prove flat earth.
Sure.
And so I'm curious to know how you take that information and say, well, you know, we're going to still perpetuate this, or we're going to try again, or we're going to spread this out to the world. And we've got a lot of young people that are seeing this and saying, yeah, well, now I question this, when, as far as I know, and from what I understand, the Neil deGrasse Tysons of the world that have a lot of training in physics and everything else can basically say, here's the equation that disproves that. Do you get what I'm
got
saying?
Got it.
And I'm not trying to insult your beliefs here.
I genuinely want
to understand philosophically, you know, how you guys are taking that in the world of fake news, in the world of fake information, in the world of perpetuation unchecked through social media, where a lot of information gets out there that is just demonstrably false.
Got it. There's a couple of questions. I'll see if I can answer them in the order you laid it out. The first thing is, we don't have to emphasize us versus any other media, because we don't ever have to come out and say we're real and other people aren't, or we don't have to differentiate between our beliefs and other beliefs we may not agree with, mostly because the viewer, you know, the people that have these, The thing has changed is this, and that is, if you're getting all your media through one device, you know, if kids aren't watching television, the biggest screen I saw anybody over the vacation, you know, I watched a bunch of kids, was on their laptop. And that was generally because they were doing other things. Most of the time, though, they were on this. If you're right. getting YouTube videos and social media videos and other information through this in the same breath as, you know, the news channels, CNN and NBC and ABC, what's the difference? Meaning you're getting bombarded with images, and honestly, the major networks, and there's only, what, five of them, get lost in the shuffle. Now, when it comes to us, how shall I put this? I try to put this as gently as I can, because I don't want to sound scary when we do this.
As long as you don't swear, because it's
No. I never.
Other than that, you're good.
No. I never swear. But yeah, the short version is, because why does this keep gaining traction? Why do we keep just getting bigger and bigger and weirder? And I mean, we were just on the cover of Popular Science and the cover of Newsweek. And
it's not so much increasing so much as it is how you're differentiating yourself, because what you believe, you don't believe to be fake news.
No. Not at all. No,
of course. Yeah, but yeah. What I think a lot of the world looks at that and they're like, oh, fake news. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, and they should. They absolutely should. They should go at it skeptically. In fact, if you were to come out and say, oh yeah, this is, you know, I'm buying it, I'd think there was something wrong with you. In fact, I said it in my last book. I said, look, if you buy into this in the first 20 minutes, there's something wrong. Because everybody's knee-jerk response takes a minimum like 2 weeks. I mean, I saw a woman flip in about an hour, but I think she was super, super open-minded. Women generally are. But the short version is this. We've created a way of explaining the world, which is far easier than the heliocentric model, the solar system model. The solar system model, so if I was holding, I don't have my props in front of me, but if I have a globe in one hand and a snow globe in the other, right?
Okay.
The globe, and they look roughly the same size. However, the globe cannot exist on its own. The globe needs a massive solar system around it, you know, with the sun and other planets. It needs a galaxy around that and a universe around that. And it needs what, geometry and trigonometry and calculus and quantum mechanics and all that. Snow globe needs nothing. Snow globe barely needs algebra to survive. I mean, and it doesn't need anything else outside it. And people are not to quote The Art of War too much, but the old saying, which I love, which is people are like water. They always take the path of least resistance. I'm trying not to say that people are lazy, but if the snow globe model is easier to explain than the globe model, that's what they're going for. And you say, well, it's just because it's easy doesn't mean it's right. I'm going, no, it doesn't. But it means they're going to follow that path because it's easier to do. And you know how many, you know, I don't know if you were in math club or chess club or all the other clubs in high school, but those clubs, as you know, are very, very small, because the science nerds and the geeks, and I was one of those nerds, it's a very small group. The masses are very basic, and which is what, you know, you can't get the term more easier than, or more easier, good English, the term flatter. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's two syllables, and everybody's heard of it, and so, but everyone has that knee-jerk response. They go, oh, it's terrible, awful. And then they look into it and they go, well, they'll do the same thing I do, which is why literally the first chapter of my book is called Look Away. I literally dissuade people from going to it. I say, don't look. And I'm not trying to do the reverse psychology thing, which is, you know, don't think about elephant. I'm not trying to do that, but I'm trying to say, don't look at it because it's a rabbit hole. And once you go down it, you're not coming back. It is the greatest red pill, blue pill. One more thing.
Yeah.
I know you're probably going to go over in time, but way it's probably going to be, which is when it came to the documentary, you know, it's like, oh yeah, fine, Jaron screwed up his experiment, right? And Bob, you know, but you gotta remember, but there's a lot of power of editing here. Jaron didn't screw up his experiment. The director left a lot of stuff out, but he wasn't going to clarify. In fact, Jaron was just livid after the movie was over, because he's like, well, he goes, what happened? He goes, why didn't they show blah 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 blah? And it's like, well, because the director made a stand, and because the director and the producers all agreed, it's like, this thing shouldn't be pushed out to kids. And one more thing, because I remember what you said, it's like, well, because Neil deGrasse Tyson has the equation to disprove the flat earth, does he? What's that equation? I've never heard of it. And we put it, in fact, we've been using science, I've memorized so many different little scientific factoids, and in learning the formula, that's one of our big things. It's like the curvature of the earth is 8 inches per mile squared, supposedly. Why can't we ever see it? And HD technology, and to your point, technology has changed it. We wouldn't have had nearly attraction 15 years ago. But HD technology has changed that to where now with HD cameras, you can look way, way farther than you should be able to with the curvature of the Earth. But nobody even thought about it because 99 out of 100 people on the street, well, maybe 1 in 1,000 people on the street even know what the curvature formula is. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I ramble.
Right. Well, no, and you know, I appreciate that. I just, you know, I am curious because like you mentioned one thing and we are a little over on time, but so I want to follow up with one or two more things. But you know, you mentioned that the vast majority of us are actually getting our we're getting our media content from our mobile phone. But what I'm talking about more is I can use my mobile phone to go to the Washington Post or the New York Times or scientific journals, or I can go to Facebook, you know, and just see what my friends are posting, whatever hyperbolic, you know, article, and maybe it's a well-reasoned thought out article, or maybe it's something different. And one of the things that I'm curious to know, just because I think the most of the planet would label you fake news, even though you believe this and you don't believe that it is fake, you know, and sure. So I'm curious in that sense, and I think this will be my last question is, you stated nearly at the beginning of this interview that you basically wouldn't be here if it wasn't for YouTube. YouTube is a free platform that gives you the ability to post whatever content you want, short of violating their terms of services. And by virtue of that, anybody can put out anything. And so in that sense, if you are sitting there, let's say pushing out things about flat earth clues or, hey, why don't you think about it in this way? Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't necessarily, and please forgive me here because I'm that doesn't necessarily make you an authority in science or in flat earth or whatever. And so by virtue of that, the audience has to take you at your word, or you have to show credibility in some way, shape or form. I have a degree from this. I've studied this, or, you know, whatever that is. And again, I'm not sitting here trying to knock you or
oh, no, it's fine.
Down. I'm trying to get to that. To that core of it, where I think you guys have built a community. And just out of curiosity, how many people do you estimate are in Flat Earth right now or actively involved? You might not have like membership cards, but how many people did you get at your conference? Out of curiosity,
which one?
Okay, the one I know of is the one from Behind the Curve. I'm assuming you do it annually. And so I'd be curious to know what those numbers are.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was. I gotta remember that was. Oh yeah, that was 2 years ago, and I think we had 500-600 at that one. And then after that, last year we had Denver and Edmonton, Canada, and London, and then this year we had. I mean, it's just the growth has been amazing. I did conferences in Calgary, Stockholm, London, Los Angeles, South Carolina, Dallas, and Auckland. And it just went through the freaking roof. But so, I mean, how many people? Millions. Millions of people. I now exact numbers don't know because 90% of our members are in the closet. You know, every other email I get is from somebody who says, oh yeah, I'm totally with you. But there's no way I'm going to come out to my friends and family and coworkers. I can't because they're, you know, they're worried. They're scared. Why wouldn't they be? The biggest one is coworkers, because you can deal with your friends and family, but your coworkers
you can't really quantify a number. Then it's 5,000 members, 2,000 members,
millions.
You're saying that millions of people around the globe, of the 7 billion of us, you have millions that are subscribing to Flat Earth.
Absolutely millions. No question.
I question though.
Well, no.
I'll
just go off the U.gov survey. Look at it yourself. If they say that 3-5% of Americans just off the bat, and every percentage point is 3.3 million, and if a third of the kids 18 to 24, do that demographic yourself. Millions of people. I'm not kidding you. There's a reason why we're making the covers of the things. I did a commercial in Melbourne last year. How does that happen? It wasn't because we only had a few thousand members. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you there are millions of people.
Okay. Well, Mark, I want to thank you for your time, and I've got to wrap it up or else I'm going to run over.
Oh no, that's
you know, for my segment here. Sure. Yeah, I honestly could talk to you for the next couple of hours. I have just so many questions on how this proliferates on the internet, just for my own research on on internet communication. But if people want to find you, I like I said, I'm more than happy to give you a plug for whatever you want to plug. So
the easiest way is just to Google Flat Earth Clues.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show with Nick Espinoza. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Ruddenberg. Her email is ursula@pacifica.org. Again, that's ursula@pacifica.org. Again, I'm Nick Espinoza here in Chicago. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9:59. Coming up next on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein presents his impeachment trial update. And at 11 on Between the Covers, join Ramiza Shamoon Koya, author of the new novel The Royal Abduls, from the Portland Forest Avenue Press, in conversation with Joanna Rose, Portland-based writer and teacher and author of the award-winning novel Little Miss Strange. And remember, all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Vancouver Variety Market, Saturday, February 1st, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Minnehaha Grange in Vancouver, Washington. Vancouver Variety Market is an indoor marketplace held twice a month on every first and third Saturday, featuring a wide variety of vendors offering new and used merchandise, household goods, vintage pieces, antiques, handcrafted works of art, pop culture collectibles, and more. Again, that's Vancouver Variety Market on Saturday, February 1st from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Minnehaha Grange, 4905 Northeast St. John's Road in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of When We Cry on Sunday, February 2nd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Siren Theater in Portland. When We Cry takes a look into the pain of a Black woman